I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
How have you been? How is your pod? Is that what your little group of people you're allowed to interact with? How's your pod doing?
My pod's pretty good. It's been kind of a bummer that the weather hasn't been super nice this week, but you know, it's all right. It's not too bad, and one of my roommates and I went in on a case of wine together. So we just went ahead and conceded to we're going to be drinking at least a case of wine, like sometime, eventually.
How many bottles is that? Is it like 12?
Yeah.
That's six each. It's like, we got 15 days left at least in this pause. That's plenty of time.
And even afterwards, if we do return to some sort of social, what's the opposite of social distancing? Social togetherness?
Gathering?
Social gatherings, which I wouldn't really jump to do that anyway. Yeah. But if we do, then I assume that I'll still like wine. So
That's true. It doesn't go bad as long as it's close. That's true.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have more than 15 days. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I think,
just up here in New York for sure.
Right. I mean, personally, like my life is just going to be different from now on because New York City schools are closed for the rest of the year. So I'm not going to go back to teaching anytime soon. So, yeah. It's going to be different.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Well, you got a case of wine. At least there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Good, you know, it's as well as can be expected. I don't know. I just kind of just take it one day at a time. Like, just focus on the most, like, miniature amount of time possible. Like, well, in the next 2 hours I should eat a food and drink a water, and then I'll figure out what to do after that.
Like, just, yeah,
you know, if you pull back it looks scary, but just in the minute to minute it's like, oh, this is manageable. You know, I don't know what, like, I've looked at the guidelines for how restaurants can reopen once we get to that phase, which we don't have the numbers right now, just here in New York City, like as far as hospitalizations and stuff, we don't have the numbers to even move on to a phase of reopening. But once we do, like the stuff that restaurants are going to have to do to open, I just, you know, it's just like, I think restaurants, bars, it should be a pleasurable experience. Mm. And I don't really know how pleasurable it's gonna be to like sit, like the spacing wise, so you know you're gonna be at a restaurant that is probably at like a fourth capacity based on the spacing you're gonna have to have, and you're gonna be like served by people in masks and gloves, and but you're not gonna be able to wear a mask when you're eating. I don't know. I feel like it's not gonna be a relaxed environment and like a nice experience for a while, so I don't really know how actually feasible that is as a business model, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it's gotta, like, the takeout shift that has happened is gonna be a more permanent thing. And also, we've gotta keep those to-go cocktails.
I hope that is, if there is one, I'm not gonna say a silver lining, because that is to diminish the full impact of what we're dealing with up here, but If takeout cocktails can stick around, I think that would be really nice. Because what we have realized is that, well, I was going to say not everybody's wandering around drunk just because you can have liquor delivered. But the thing, it's the exact amount of wandering around drunk New York already did or, you know, is already doing during the quarantine. So I don't know. But it is definitely a way that cocktail bars have been able to stay open and keep getting business. It's, you know, it works. Like, I think I've had some really really great cocktails delivered to me and been able to support some programs that I really love. So that's cool.
Nice.
But yeah, you know, I mean, restaurants run on incredibly tight margins. And I don't know how people don't know that are making these plans, but because it's like a commonly understood thing, you know, you have a bad month, you might go under. And so telling a restaurant, well, okay, you can reopen, but you can reopen at a third capacity, half capacity, a fourth. It really just depends on how small your space is and how tight you pack people in.
Right.
You can, you know, you can operate on less capacity. And it's kind of telling somebody like, well, you can, you know, you can bleed out fast, you can bleed out slow.
Yeah.
We're not going to stop the bleeding.
Like, yeah. It's just something that you have to factor in how much restaurants pay in rent costs. And it's just, I mean, things are going to change in New York for a long time, I think.
Yeah. I mean, if they could do something about the small business rent situation, yeah, I think that would be clutch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know. That's what I would like, even more than my own personal rent as like an individual. It's like if my job could be there when I go back and if other people's jobs could be there, that's going to be super cool. But who knows? Anyway, we're not. Okay, so that's where the world's at. Let's get away from that. Let's talk about something cool and interesting. We're talking today about, well, maybe one of my top like three favorite spirits in the world. There was like so much information in this episode that I just feel like all over the place, but I'm really excited to talk about it. We're talking about mezcal today.
Yeah, mezcal. I'm very excited to talk about it. This week, our topic kind of came up because we realized that Cinco de Mayo was coming up, and although the timing of our episode doesn't distinctly come out on Cinco de Mayo, we thought it would be really cool to celebrate one of the prominent spirits that has a really, really rich history in Mexico. So that's why we're talking about mezcal this week.
Yeah, like we'll definitely, like, I think the history of Cinco de Mayo is something that we are gonna, I hope this podcast is around for more than a year so we can circle back to that.
Yeah, but, definitely.
We've had some emails about talking about mezcal or questions about mezcal, so this seemed timely.
Yeah, and we love mezcal, so it was something that we were both really excited to talk about.
Yeah, and there's a lot to talk about with mezcal. That's the other part, too. There's a lot there, so let's get into it.
Yeah, let's get right into it. So I really want to start with kind of the surface question. When people are first learning about mezcal, mostly we want to know, what's the difference between tequila and mezcal? Like, are they the same? Are they completely different spirits? Like, what does it mean? So just to give you a basic overview of what that answer is going to be like, this is like the squares and rectangles analogy again. All tequila is technically mezcal, but most mezcal is not tequila. And that is a very broad overview of how this information is going to lay out, but just keep that in mind from the beginning, because mezcals are made from agave plants, or the indigenous word is maguey. So tequila is actually made from one particular blue agave species, and there are over 250 species of agave native to Mexico. And within, I mean, just with that, there are over 150 varietals of mezcal. And this is kind of similar to wine production, where the different species, just like in wine, how the different species of grapes vary depending upon not just their production and preparation, but the climate and the species itself. So you might have, like, a Pinot Noir is going to taste different from a Merlot, even though they're both grapes. There's different varietals of mezcal made from different species of agave that are going to have different flavor profiles and qualities.
Right. And it's very, I mean, that parallel really holds up, right? Like, it's the region, it's the varietal, but it's also the region, it's the land it grows in. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very, like, this is where this type of mezcal is made, and it's made with this type of agave in, like, this location geographically.
Yeah. And it can be made from different combinations of various agave species, which really allows a huge variety of flavors. That kind of makes it so the combinations and the possibilities are really endless. Mexico produces over 6 million liters of mezcal annually, and most of that is produced in Oaxaca. They actually have a saying in Oaxaca, and I'm not going to say the Spanish because I'm not going to do very well at that. So the translation is, for everything bad, mezcal, and for everything good as well.
I like that. I'll adopt that. Yeah. I'll take that.
You know, you having a good day or you having a bad day? Have some mezcal. Are you having a good day? Have another one. Cool. So yeah. I'll drink to that.
Cheers.
The word mezcal comes from mezcali, which is a Nahuatl word. Nahuatl is one of the Udo-Aztecan languages, and it means oven-smoked agave. Smoked and cooked agave. That is what the word, where the word mezcal comes from. So that leads me right into, how do you make mezcal? The production is, it starts the same as tequila. You harvest the plant, and they then extract the heart of the plant. The heart is called the piña, which is kind of funny because some of the articles that I found, or at least one of them, said like that translates to pineapple, which is obviously not correct. It's not because it's not a pineapple, but
it looks like
it looks like a giant pineapple.
Yeah, because what they chop off all the fronds, the agave. You know, we've seen if you've seen the agave, it's like big fronds. When you chop it all down, it does look exactly like a pineapple. There was a brand of mezcal that we were working with for a while at my bar that was very, very recently imported to America. So it still had its old, like they had just directly translated the label, but not very well. So it said it was like made from 100% pineapple. We were like, what?
I know.
Because it was that's right. What we want. Piña.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, this is not pineapple mezcal. It's just made from the piña, which is the heart of the agave.
Exactly. So you cut off the leaves and the roots. The leaves are also sometimes called the spines because they look, they're like really long, spiky leaves. Like the top of a pineapple. So they take the heart and they cook it for 3 days in a pit oven, which is basically an oven made out of the earth and hot stones, similar to how you would smoke barbacoa. Cooking the agave plant prior to fermentation is one of the major distinctions from tequila. And the underground cooking is really what gives mezcal its smoky flavor. This is the exact point where this is different from tequila. Then you take that smoked agave plant and you mash it up with a stone wheel. Then it's fermented in large vats or barrels with a little bit of water added. And then they distill the mash. It's traditionally distilled in clay or copper pots. They actually distill it twice. And the reason for that is simply to raise the alcohol content. After that, you can have joven mezcal. That actually just means, joven means young. So that is unaged mezcal. That is a category. But it also can be aged in barrels, usually between 1 month and 4 years. But some specific mezcals are aged up to 12 years. And so we'll get into the variations with that. Because along with the agave species used, fruits and herbs can also be added during fermentation to influence the flavor profile. And we've talked about pechuga on the show before.
Yeah.
And that is, like, just to remind y'all, that is the mezcal that, along with adding, you know, they add cinnamon, apples, plums, etc. to the mezcal while it's distilling. But they also add either a chicken, duck, or turkey breast.
Yeah.
And that gives it a very distinct flavor.
When it goes, like, in the still, like, so it kind of, the flavors of that evaporate up with the booze.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's become, like, a weird, kind of like a cool stylistic choice with some other brands. Like, they make pechuga styles with, like, just throwing whatever they can. Like, I think we talked about the one that was made with, like, fancy, like, smoked pork. Like,
yeah.
It's just throw some meat in there. Yeah. See what it does to your booze. Like other spirits, like whiskey has taken that. And like, what if we throw some ham in with our whiskey?
Hey, why not?
Distill it.
I mean,
pechuga style whiskey.
You know, so if you're vegans out there, if you see pechuga style anything, know that that is not vegan.
Yeah, there are a couple companies that have made pechugas with just like the fruit and grains and and stuff. So there are some brands that have made vegan pechugas, but that's you probably know if you're drinking it, because those are pretty hard to come by, and they go out of their way to say that. Pechuga doesn't necessarily imply it has to be meat, but it is that filling the distiller or filling the still with like fruits and vegetables and spices and herbs and seasonal things.
So for that reason, I'm just going to keep adding to the list of what makes mezcal different from tequila. Tequila has a lot of other rules and restrictions that we would get into on a different episode about tequila, but we're talking about mezcal. So
I know, we're just like, tequila, we're not going to talk about mezcal.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to talk about mezcal before tequila anyway, because it's the predecessor and it has a much longer tradition. Yeah. So mezcal can be 100% agave, or it can be about 80% agave and then mixed with other ingredients like, you know, like apples or herbs or other fruits, or, you know, even a chicken breast. So within those categories, there are four different types. You can have, as we mentioned, joven, which is also, you can also call it blanco or white mezcal. It is clear and unaged. And then there's dorado, which means golden, which is also not aged, but then a coloring agent is added. And then you get into reposado or añejado, which is aged in barrels 2 to 9 months. And then añejo is aged in barrels at least 12 months. And añejo is the only classification that does need to be 100% agave. Mm-hmm. So I bet some people are wondering, what about the worm? Were you wondering about the worm?
You know, so I first encountered mezcal in college. So this was, I guess this makes sense with like kind of the mezcal's proliferation in America. This was like 2004, 5, 6 maybe ish. And the only brand of mezcal you could get was Monte Albán, which was just, it's still garbage. caramel coloring and hate in a bottle. And it came with, the reason we bought it was because it had a worm in it or a larva of some kind. Yeah. I don't know. Like, that was, and I mean, that was the entire selling point.
Right.
You know, and I remember the label said like, oh, when you drink the bottle, you eat the worm and then you get the warrior spirit. It was probably like vaguely racist and, you know.
Yeah.
Like
not, yeah. Like. So you might have had listeners, you might have had an experience like Taylor did, or chances are you've either seen or heard of mezcal with a worm inside the bottle. It's actually the larva of a moth. It's a particular moth that really likes agave plants. So they have a name for it. The larva is called gusano. And then the type of mezcal that contains one of these larvae is called con gusano. Just means with the worm. So there are a few different theories and explanations for why this tradition started. And those theories vary a lot. Some believe it's good luck, especially if you find the worm in your glass. Others see it as it's a sign that the mezcal is strong. In order to pickle the larva, the potency has to be pretty high. So that's another sign. It's supposed to be a sign that the mezcal is good and potent. But like you said, just because it has a worm in it doesn't necessarily mean that it's great mezcal. No. So one theory is that there's a story that there was a distiller named Jacobo Lozano Paez, and that he started including the worm in his bottles of mezcal in the 1940s, which is really not that long ago. So that kind of says a lot to how recently this tradition started. And he started doing it because he thought that the gusano imparted a unique taste to the agave. So he started adding it to his spirits on purpose. Like, it kind of makes sense that, like, you know, if you're harvesting agave and there's this larva, this moth larva that lives on it, that you might accidentally get it in to your spirit and then notice that it tastes a little bit different, or, you know, at least he believed that it did. So he started doing it on purpose. But more than likely, especially considering how recently it started, it seems to be more of a gimmick, like a marketing ploy. There are old myths about the worm giving special powers, but adding it to the bottle is a relatively new thing.
And it's not really a thing that's done by more prominent brands in the industry. You know, it kind of, it's, I feel like it's kind of a mass, like a growing more outdated thing as far as respected brands of mezcal.
Yeah. This is just me speculating, but I think that it's possible that it kind of started as like a, not something that people who were making mezcal were doing on purpose, adding a worm to it, but like that it might have happened accidentally. And if you did get a worm in your glass just by happenstance, then that was considered really lucky.
So you're, so like a distilled spirit, like I get that the worms can be in the agave, they can be in the plant, right? But for them to get through the distillation process, which literally relies on something evaporating and condensing.
Yeah.
Like, no. How would that happen?
It doesn't. It wouldn't. It wouldn't. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. My theory doesn't hold water. But
well, no. I don't know. It's like, because to me, it felt like a way to, like, gimmicky sales. I'm like, look, it's exotic. There's a worm in it.
Yeah.
Like,
well. I think that that's, like, more than likely that's actually what it is. So just so you know, you might not want to just rely on, if you're choosing a mezcal, you might not want to rely on the worm to tell you which one is good. That's not really the traditional way of drinking with a worm.
The only ones that I see on the shelf that still have the worm are generally the ones that are also not made of the good stuff. Okay. Not made the right way.
Right. So how do you drink mezcal? Traditionally, mezcal is drunk straight, meaning with nothing else, and it's served room temperature in a wine glass, and it's usually accompanied by sliced oranges or lemon or perhaps a lime that's sprinkled with a mixture called sal de gusano, which literally means worm salt, and that is made of ground fried larvae, ground chili peppers, and salt.
Do you also sometimes get it served with crickets?
Ooh, yeah. I was just thinking, like, I mean, you know, I actually was thinking that that worm salt doesn't sound so bad. Like, it's fried up, kind of like you would prepare crickets. So, that's cool. I mean...
Yeah, I did not know that. I was at a mezcal bar with my mother, and it said mezcal with a traditional, like, cricket accoutrement or something, you know, to that effect. And I was like, oh, that's got to be, like, a term for something, right? Like... can't be actual crickets. And then we ordered it and it just crickets.
There was there's a bar in the Lower East Side. I think it's actually called the Black Ant. And they have a salt that's ants. It's like ground ants and chili and salt. And that's like whole thing.
Bugs are a great source of protein for a lot of cultures. Yeah. You know, it, here in America with our limited palates, like, oh, that's crazy. But there was actually a place, and it's long gone, but around the time that I was probably drinking the worm mezcal, there was a place in around Union Square called Galaxy Global Eatery that looked like a spaceship inside. Ooh. And they had fried cricket tacos. And they were... that was like my favorite thing in the world at the time. Like back when I ate meat, I didn't waste time with like hot dogs. I ate all of the weird,
all the bugs. That's cool. I'm open to trying fried bugs.
They're really nutty and crispy. Yeah. I think I could be more easily lured back to the world of like eating animals with grasshopper or cricket tacos than I could with like bacon.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's fine, but oh, a bug is can be good.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm open to it. Well, so that's how it's traditionally served, but how do you drink it? It is said that you kiss mezcal. Definitely as opposed to shooting it, you would not do that to mezcal, especially a really nice mezcal, but that's you kiss mezcal, that's kind of describing the very delicate sips that you would take. It's like, you know, you're not gulping it, you're not taking big swigs, you're just letting it kind of touch your lips and go down. Very nice. I just took a little kiss of my mezcal.
I know. Now that's like, that made me want some food. One of the prominent brands, Del Maguey, which I'll talk a bit more in a minute, but they always recommend, and they make them to go along with their product, these little, they're called capitas, and they're little clay bowls.
Ooh.
That are supposed to bring out like the flavors and kind of warm it appropriately in your hand.
Nice.
So you'll see it at a lot of like mezcal bars. You'll get it either in a capita, like a little clay bowl. Sometimes there's also like a little woven basket that you'll get mezcal in.
Oh, I've seen those. Tightly woven basket.
Yeah. So there are some really interesting like traditional mezcal serving vessels that have their own properties that are supposed to sort of enhance. I like the clay bowl because I love that sort of, it's like a, whenever I say it's like licking a rock, that doesn't sound good, but it is good.
If it's a clean rock, you know, I'm into it.
Yeah, it's like a quality you find in like, when you say that it's like Sauvignon Blanc, everyone's like, oh, I get it. But it's like, oh, it's in mezcal too. But that the clay kind of brings that out in the mezcal. I don't know. So if you run into like the woven baskets or the capitas, that's like a really unique, specific, recommended way to drink mezcal.
Nice. That's awesome. So let's get a little bit into the history. Just a little history for you. So before the Spanish colonized Mexico, the maguey was sacred and very much incorporated into religious rituals and mythology. It was also a major part of the economy, similar to like the way that we use industrial hemp. They used it to make all sorts of things like medicine, rope, textiles, tortillas, lots of stuff. And it wasn't actually distilled the way that we know it today. It wasn't distilled until after the Spanish colonization in the 16th century. So the Spanish had learned distillation from the Middle East and the Mediterranean, basically where everyone else in Europe learned it. But that's not to say strictly that the indigenous people, the Aztecs and other indigenous peoples, didn't have distillation knowledge. It's kind of unclear whether they had it or not. We know, I mean, and I would say like that's a fair statement to make, that they definitely could have had distillation knowledge, because we know like the Aztecs and the Mayans and other cultures within the land did have advanced, not like mathematical knowledge and stuff like that. But culturally, they probably wouldn't have used distillation knowledge in the way that Europe was using it, because as a culture, they restricted alcohol consumption. They took public drunkenness as a very serious issue. It was punishable by death. And so generally, they favored lower alcoholic beverages. So the mezcal that they were drinking was made from fermenting the maguey, not distilling it. So it would have been a lot lower in alcohol. But the tradition of drinking mezcal continues in the same way that they would drink it back then, because of the occasions that you would drink mezcal. And there are lots of occasions to drink it. Basically, you know, there's a number of reasons you would drink it: for a baptism or a wedding or a funeral or planting or harvesting, or if you're sick or if you just got better or falling in love, falling out of love.
I like, it's like, so don't get drunk, but just drink it all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
It would have been dangerous if they had highly distilled spirits, I guess.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and it was like, it was definitely used in rituals a lot. And just kind of like celebration, they revered it as sort of this elixir of the gods. So, you know, it you can find a lot of occasions to drink it. Remember the Oaxacan quote, bad fortune, drink some mezcal. Good fortune, that's an even better reason to drink mezcal. So, yeah.
I like that.
So that's like the history, but I think you have a little bit more on this. I found the lore and the legends, the mythology, really, really cool and fun and dramatic.
Yeah, there is a, I mean, that's kind of, so here was, here's some behind the scenes. When we first envisioned this episode, you know, we're talking about like, oh, you know, we'll talk about how, like, the how it's made, what it is part, and then I really wanted to talk about some of my favorite Mezcal producers and kind of do some research into them. And I went down a rabbit hole, and that's a pun, but you won't know why for a minute. As far as like getting into like the first name and then the history behind the name of it, I'm like, oh no, this is a whole thing that led me to the mythology. Because there's a lot of really cool mythology behind there. You've got a couple like different religions in this area, so you know, we were talking how beforehand how there's some overlap in some of the myths I found, some of the myths that Liz found, and it's maybe like same god, two names, similar cultures influencing each other situation. But I don't know, they're good stories. So in any case, let's get into them. I started with Del Maguey Mezcal, which was what I was originally just going to talk about, the mezcal, and then I got stuck on the word maguey, which is you know, it's a word for agave, but then where that word comes from and like the roots in Aztec mythology around the creation of the maguey. How we get the agave plant, according to Aztec mythology, starts with a bit of a love story. So our first character in that is Ehecatl, who's the Aztec god of winds. He was a powerful god. He had a lot of responsibilities on his shoulders. He had to blow rain clouds to the fields of farmers that would appease him with sacrifices. He would blow the sun and the moon into place each day. You know, a lot on his plate. The activities of a fellow deity, the goddess Itzpapalatl, caught his eye one day. Now, Itzpapalatl was, she was just a badass. She was like a skeletal warrior goddess with like jaguar claws. She had wings edged in obsidian knives. This gives her the nickname Obsidian Butterfly. She ruled over a paradise world. She hung out with a bunch of, she like, or led a bunch of star demons that devoured people during solar eclipses. Whoa. Like, took human form every now and then to like seduce and tear apart a man. Just, you know, goddess stuff.
She sounds like fun.
This is an aside, but it was a really cool moment for me to realize. If anybody's ever read The Invisibles, the like seminal Vertigo comic from the 90s written by Grant Morrison, there's a character, Lord Fanny, who's an amazing character. And in her backstory, you find out that she had this goddess that kind of imbued her with power. This is that goddess. Like, there's a drawing of it in the comic book, but this is actually what the comic book is referencing, which I did not realize.
That's awesome.
Anyway, that's, you know, For the nerds out there, this is that goddess. But anyway, like all that stuff, you know, obsidian knives, tearing people apart, that's fine. But what really got under the wind god's skin was that she had a habit of stealing sunlight and only giving it back to people when they would make enough human sacrifices for her.
Well, that's a little cruel, I'd say. It's kind
of
mean.
I mean, it seems like a lot of the Aztec gods kind of like they were about that. So I don't know why this, like, but Ehecatl was like, no, I gotta come have a talk to you because you can't go stealing sunlight. I mean, he was also like he was a god of like, because of his association with the wind and clouds, and that would lead to rain. He was associated with the harvest, so maybe like stealing sunlight, it fucked with the crops. You know, there might have been some legitimate beef there, but he decided to like hit up Itzpapalatl and ask her to stop this.
Nicely? That's what he was planning to do?
Yeah, he was going to have a talking to, you know.
Okay.
So he goes to her paradise world to have a talk. But along the way, he meets her granddaughter, this goddess by the name of Mahuel. He falls in love instantly. They fall in love instantly. You know, she's just this beautiful goddess. And so he absconds with her to Earth. Now, this pisses off Itzpapalatl. In the ranking of people you don't want to piss off, like a winged and clawed skeletal goddess leading a pack of star demons is like up there.
Yeah.
But, you know, as these stories often go, it's not the wind god, but it's Mahuel that paid the price. So the lovers descended to Earth. They disguised themselves as a beautiful tree because, I don't know, that's a thing that gods did back in the day. That's a mythical thing. You know, that's a cross-cultural thing you do.
Great.
So they disguise themselves as a tree, but they are found. The star demons, like, they strike them with lightning bolts. They rip them to shreds. Mahuel is killed in this, and Ehecatl is grief-stricken. He buries her remains, and from those remains, the first maguey plant is born. So from these kind of tragic beginnings, the goddess Mawel went on to lead a pretty rock star life. She moved on from her flighty wind god, Bo, and marries the god Paracatl, who's the lord of the land of medicines and also a god of pulque, which
That's
is
great.
Yeah, so they have a lot in common, you know.
Yeah,
I'm the goddess of agave. You're a god of pulque. Let's party, and they do. They party so hard that they give birth to 400 rabbit gods.
Great.
They give birth to these 400 rabbit god children. She feeds them pulque from her 400 breasts. Like, which, oof, that was a fact I should have mentioned earlier. Wow. 400 breasts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And these kids, they party hard. They become like the representation of like all of the possible faces of intoxication, or like all of the transcendent states you might reach in intoxication. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, it was a weird rabbit hole around the word magay. There,
yeah.
It ended with 400 sexy partying rabbits.
Yes.
There you go.
Sexy rabbits. Well, I did come across that myth. I'm glad that you really went in depth. There's some stuff I hadn't heard before. That's that's a really great story.
She started out just like unassuming, just beautiful lady, grew into a goddess with 400 boobs. Great. Yeah. Party.
Well, you know what? I think can beat 400 breasts.
What can beat 400 breasts?
40,000 breasts.
You're going to one-up me in the... Wow, okay, yeah.
Okay.
What is this?
So I found another legend. This is from the religion of the Zapotec people. So the Zapotec goddess, with a similar job and a similar description, and actually kind of a similar name, her name is Mahatl. She's the Magay god in the Zapotec religion. And she's very cold and very sober, but she's very generous. Her body was the trunk of a magay tree, but instead of leaves, she had 40,000 breasts. And out of those breasts, wow, flowed the elixir of the gods, right? So she was pretty, like, she was pretty much like a stone cold goddess. And one day, some of the worms that like to hang out on agave plants burrowed into her heart, and that's when she started feeling feelings.
Oh no.
So she started feeling like arousal and affection and eventually love, and she fell in love with a handsome and brave but kind of timid warrior named Chag. I want to say it's probably pronounced Chog, but Chag is funny. So
this is like Chag.
Yeah,
the brave warrior Chag.
Yeah, it's okay. Spelled Chag. He felt that he wasn't worthy of her, so to try to make him feel better, basically she let him drink from her most beautiful and supple breast, and he did drink until he got drunk and became kind of a mess, just like kind of had a meltdown. He's like, I can't take this anymore. Make me a god or become a woman. Basically, like, he's like in turmoil because he's immortal and she's a goddess.
God, this is like every relationship ever, right?
Yes, actually. The story kind of ends there. Like, that's the end of these lovers. So you can kind of, like, she was basically like, no. I'm good. That's okay.
I let you drink from my favorite breast, and that's the shit you come back with?
Yeah, no, that's not
you
how
want
this
me
works,
to become
honey.
A person, or you get to be a god?
No,
okay, no.
No, I'm good. So yeah, that was the fun. That's the fun myth that I found. The other one that I found involved a lightning bolt, and it was just kind of like a brief origin of Mezcal. This is a little bit more of like the within the physical realm, the lore around a lot of spirits, like something happened accidentally and then we found this thing and it was great, we drank it just because. Just like basically the agave plant gets struck by lightning and it singes the heart and cooks it and smokes it and opens it up, and then the juice comes out and it's delicious. So that's just like a little brief thing. Village to village, you would get a different variation on that story. Hmm. Without gods involved, that's the lightning bolt story at its like core. But
well, I think, you know, that's the idea that somebody stumbled across something that fermented naturally, and then we're like, oh, this is nice. That's the base of a lot of booze. Yeah. So that makes sense. Whether it was struck by lightning or just naturally, you know, fermented, it's hard to say. But I really, this is another weird aside. Every weird kid goes through, like, I got really into Greek mythology or Roman mythology at some point in your youth. Like, I don't know a lot about Aztec or Zapotec mythology. So it was cool to kind of go down mm-hmm. these, like, little, like, oh, wow, there's a lot of the same hijinks. There's some similar, like, some parallels. Yeah. That obviously these cultures were growing up independently. So it's just sort of cool to see that.
Yeah.
One thing that this is totally random, but when I was researching this, I think we might have talked about it when we talked about sake. But one of my favorite things about Japanese culture is that they see a rabbit in the moon. Whereas we talk about a man in the moon, they see a rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
They specifically see a rabbit pounding mochi. But that's, if you're a Sailor Moon fan, Tsukino Usagi is the rabbit of the moon. And that's, anyway. But they have a similar understanding of the moon in Aztec culture, where the idea was like the sun and the moon were the same brightness. And because they were like, nah, they can't be the same. So... like the sun god threw a rabbit at the moon and was like, you gotta chill and be less bright than me. And that's why there's a rabbit on the moon.
Okay. So like it, but the moon would have been as bright as the sun, except for it's covered by a rabbit.
The shadow of a rabbit. Okay. Yeah. So that they also see a rabbit in the moon. So two cultures developing completely independently both see a rabbit in the moon. I think that's really cool.
That is cool.
So there's, you know, there's the whole, all the 400 rabbits that were like just sexy and having fun. But then there's also the rabbit in the moon. It's just cool to just experience an entirely different mythical culture that you just have not been exposed to yet.
That's awesome.
It's just, yeah. Oh, but to pull it back out to, you know, get back on topic with Mezcal. So as I mentioned, my initial goal was to talk about a couple of the brands that I like. And I'm going to just, you know, talk about two of the, I think, the major players that you see on the marketplace. The first of which is what I was referencing before, Del Maguey. Mm-hmm. Del Maguey Mezcal is definitely the brand with the biggest presence on the international marketplace. It was founded in 1995 by Ron Cooper. Ron Cooper had already established himself as like a well-known artist. He'd had a lot of artistic success. He was also a surfer who lived in California. Yeah, he traveled south of the border frequently in the 70s to surf, and that's where he kind of found a love for the culture of Oaxaca and for Mezcal, and set out to sort of make this a thing that you could, that was popular and drinkable in America. It took him 20 years to get all that figured out, but you know, now it's the brand that I think has found its way into, I think all states in America. Like, it's a pretty, you know, it's kind of the representation of Mezcal you get on the shelves. But despite its massive operation, Del Maguey still committed itself to, like, sustainability, and they support the villages. You know, we talked about earlier, the individual labels of Del Maguey are related to the villages that they come from, and those villages are still producing their traditional mezcal the way that they have always made it from their blends of agave. So even though it's a big brand, it has a commitment to sustainability, it has a commitment to supporting and allowing the villages that these mezcals are made in to be successful and have security, which is good for a big brand. You don't see that often.
Yeah.
When we talk about tequila and mezcal, anything agave based, I think I was saying this before, like, some spirits are inherently political because of the world right now, and I think tequila might be the most inherently political spirit right now. Mm-hmm. Because when you get into agave production, you know, it takes like 12 years for an agave plant to mature, if not longer. And it's something that can easily be over-harvested and decimate the communities that base their livelihoods around it by companies that just don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Too often that's the story with major agave spirit producers in Mexico. And that idea of like tequila, mezcal, agave-based spirits being somewhat of a political beverage brings me to my next favorite mezcal, which is illegal.
Oh.
So this actually, the thing that kind of loops this all together is Illegal Mezcal. It's a brand of mezcal that's been around since like 2004. And one of their ad campaigns has like three rabbits humping each other.
Cool.
That was
okay.
And I never understood where that came from. And I asked one of my buddies that worked for them, and they're like, "Oh, it's just three rabbits having sex." I was like, "What does that mean?" But now I get it. Like, it comes back to the rabbits.
Yeah, it's about it's, something.
Yes, it's not just some. They're like, "Oh yeah, we make mezcal, and here's some rabbits." So I had that aha moment of like, "Oh, that's why the rabbits are boning. They're sexy mezcal gods." Yeah, okay, of course. Thank you.
It all makes sense now.
Yeah. So Illegal Mezcal is another prominent player in the marketplace, and they have a pretty funny origin story. So it was founded by John Rexer, who was at the time around like the like late 1990s, early 2000s. He was a bar owner in Antigua, Guatemala. He ran a place by the name of Cafe Noce. Nowadays, that name is like a destination, like a pilgrimage for mezcal lovers and bartenders. It wasn't always the case. What basically happened, he wasn't happy with the available tequilas and mezcals in Antigua. So he started making trips over the border. He started going to Oaxaca and smuggling like unbranded mezcal back with him to sell at his bar.
Okay.
It became very popular. And so he had to kind of figure out how to get increasingly large numbers of bottles across the border.
Yeah.
You know, he would smuggle in duffel bags and suitcases, like 30 bottles at a time. He eventually hooked up with like a mezcalero who kind of famously said, "I have an uncle." And this led to a little bit more of an elaborate operation where he would like, he had access to a warehouse that was on the river that was on the border. So he would like take a raft over the border.
Oh.
Like loaded up with like super, you know, safe flats of mezcal. Yeah. Like it's really like it's crazy shit. One of my favorite stories that he tells from his smuggling days was like how he was trying to get like 60 some bottles across the border back to his bar, and he was with a buddy of his. They both were maybe a little drunk at the time, and they went to a market to try to get duffel bags to fill with the bottles and stuff to stuff the duffel bags with to hide the bottles. And they came across a priest outfit at the market. And his friend was like, "Oh, you should wear that. That'll make you get across the border easily because they'll trust you. If you dress like a priest." And he was like, "That seems like a good idea. I'm going to do that." Once again, definitely a bottle of mezcal in.
Such hijinks.
So they load up their duffel bags with mezcal packed in like t-shirts and books, and you know, the founder, he's dressed as a priest. His friend gets across the border, no question. He rolls up and they ask if they can like check his bags, and he's like, "Okay." And they're like, "What's in your bags?" And he says, you know, "Oh, it's like books and presents for the children." And like ask him again, like, "What's in your bags? Books and presents for the children." So what he didn't realize is his drunk friend had acquired some pornography at the market as well. And while most of the bags were packed like around the mezcal bottles, they were packed with like clothing and like innocent books, like things that you could believe a priest is bringing across the border. This particular bag that the cops checked was the one that had all of the hardcore pornography in it.
Oh, no.
So they let him go still. I mean, you know, there's that. But
his reputation as a priest was ruined.
Ruined. He did eventually, like around 2004, like cement like a legitimate business of importing the mezcal legally and then started, you know.
I mean, I'm glad that we're not like outing a fugitive right now.
No. Illegal. It's so a couple of cool things about Illegal is that I think the thing that I've had the biggest problem with, like a brand like Del Maguey or Legal, it's like, these are, you know, these are not citizens of Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. These are not even Mexican citizens that are becoming the face of mezcal companies. And that seems slightly problematic to me.
Yeah.
And the one thing about Illegal that I think is really, you kind of have to say that they do it right, is that for one, the name, a lot of people think it comes from the fact that he was smuggling illegal, or questionably legal. It wasn't necessarily illegal to bring booze back over the border. It was just the amount, but that it comes from that. But he actually credits it to recognizing the so-called illegal immigrants that, you know, work in our country, and that it's the idea of like anything being illegal is kind of obtuse.
Yeah.
Or like a person being illegal is sort of obtuse. Okay. So he named his brand in honor of illegal immigrants.
That's cool.
And what really turned me onto the brand was in the 2016 election, because whereas most alcohol companies just want to market to everybody, they want everybody to be their friend, they don't take controversial stances, Illegal Mezcal said nah when Donald Trump was making his, you know, rise to political power. Like, this is bad and we need to say something about this. And I think if you're a brand that is, especially now, like, you know, it's like a brand that's based in America, like, I think it's important, it's necessary that you recognize that the people of Mexico are who created and envisioned the product that you're selling, and you need to give back. And I think that they did that, like, as best they could. The story goes is that when, like, the founders were, you know, like, having a meeting about, you know, just like, how the fuck is this guy gonna be like a possible candidate for the presidency? That's insane. Like, how can this guy maybe be our president? And the waiter that was waiting on them, like, he overheard their conversation and just said, oh, Donald era un pendejo, which is Donald is an ass hair. And they went, oh, that's it, that's our campaign.
Yes.
So Illegal Mezcal created all of these, like, you know, like, raised all of this money for donation to, like, help at the border, and, like, campaign proceeds to go to the candidates that were running against Donald Trump based around this campaign. I got one of the shirts, and I was very lucky to have it, that said Donald Eres un Pendejo and had, like, his profile on it. They did a whole campaign, like, take a shot at Donald, like, where bartenders could tag themselves, like, drinking Illegal Mezcal, and they would donate money in response. They projected a giant Donald Eres un Pendejo on the side of one of the buildings down in Rockefeller when he was hosting on Saturday Night Live. Oh my
God, I remember seeing that.
Yeah, and I think...
Hell yeah. Yes,
and it's cool to see a company, like I said before, like, I don't necessarily want to, like, say, like, oh, what amazing good people. It's like, yes, they are. But also, that recognizes the connection between, like, hey, this product that we've managed to make a lot of money on by selling on the international, like, cocktail marketplace, it comes from Mexico.
Yeah.
That's where it was born. That's where it was made. These are the people that are being villainized right now. So it's not just, like, a nice thing we can do. It's kind of our responsibility.
Yeah, it's our obligation.
To, yeah. And I think that, you know, they set a precedent that I don't know if any liquor company has ever stepped up and taken a position like that.
I mean, it's only recently that liquor brands that have always been, I mean, Pride is a really good example of this, liquor brands taking advantage of the money that they can make off of a group. It's only been in the last year or so, like Sky Vodka, I think, is the one that features LGBTQ people in their advertising and, like, has taken a stance on that. Like, right. It's very, very rare to see a liquor company taking a stand in anything.
And, you know, bringing up the correlation with Pride is, it's a good talking point, because I do think there's that fear of, like, are you appealing to my political feelings to get profit? In the case of Illegal, I feel like they put themselves at risk as much as they could have benefited from it. You know, it was a successful campaign, but it was based out of an actual political desire to support candidates that were against Donald Trump and, like, raise money for them and raise money for families at the border. So I think that that's because with Pride, it gets kind of messy with, like, how many brands slap a rainbow on their fucking bottle and go, like, oh, we're, you know, we love the gays, but we're also a Russian company. Yeah. Like, fuck the gays.
It's easy to appeal to a certain group and not really, you don't really stand to lose anything by appealing to a certain group, but to take a stand in the opposite direction, like, basically against the bad guys or whatever, like, take a stance, like, we don't agree with this, that is ultimately so much more risky, because you're alienating a group that could be one of your consumers. So that, I mean, there's not really, you know, it's sometimes I think it's really kind of in a brand's interest to be political in some ways, but in that case, it's hard to make the argument that, like, oh, all they care about is money, when, like, they're willing to put their sales at risk.
Right. I proudly wore that t-shirt, and I worked part-time at a bar. I haven't worked there in a while, but like I was asked specifically to like not wear that shirt behind the bar because it was political, and I'm like, well, no, I'm advertising for a brand of mezcal that we sell. Like, what is wrong with that?
Yeah,
this is part of their ad campaign. I don't know. I agree. Like, I'm a little tired. I think all queer people are a little tired of pride being used to, like, we get that we're a marketable base, and so it's safe. It's safe now to put a rainbow on your shit and sell it to us. Mm-hmm. But any brand that steps up to the plate with something that's not safe is not necessarily going to be a market strategy, but you're going to do it anyway. And especially in the bar world, especially in the restaurant industry, especially in an industry that runs on the backs of largely an immigrant population. Mm-hmm. Like, for them to say, like, no, we recognize that. We recognize that our spirit is from a culture that's not ours, that we are importing. Like, we recognize the importance of Mexican culture is the backbone of what we do. Like, and we're gonna stand up for them. Like, it almost makes me disappointed in every other, like, tequila brand that didn't say the same thing. 'Cause the thing, like, and I know, like Anthony Bourdain went on, like, has a famous rant that he gave in response to, like, Donald Trump's comments about Mexican people in 2016 about how, you know, we love to drink their drinks and eat their food and, you know, puke all over their beautiful beaches when we're on spring break, but we don't respect the people, and you don't get to enjoy the product if you don't respect the people. Mm-hmm. And I like to see brands that will stand by that, because, you know, brands can and often are soulless, but to see a brand say, like, we might lose some sales from this, but this is actually important. I think it's not just, like, good. It's something we should expect and ask for from your favorite tequila brands, from your favorite mezcal brands, from your brands that literally are based around marketing a culture that is not yours to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good on you, Illegal.
And Donald is indeed an ass hair.
No truer statement was ever made. And in that specific way, you're an ass hair. You're nothing but a little gross hair on a butt.
Yeah, well, hey, that came full circle. Oh, hey. No, we went into the safe little world of mezcal and we came back out to the real world.
We got political. Well,
yeah, that's gonna happen sometimes.
Yeah, it is. You know that's yep, we care about things. So we also care about you guys, and so I have a little question that's pretty topical from one of our Patreon supporters. So this question is from Kate. Kate says, "Hi guys, I absolutely love listening to you guys and wanted to let you know you bring so much joy to my life." Aw, man.
Yay.
Thanks, Kate. You have been a distinct influence on my drinking habits. Finally built my first drink by measuring. Thank you for the margarita inspiration. Awesome. Way to go, Kate.
Nice.
But was also convinced to buy mezcal for the first time. Now, our little book of cocktail recipes at home suggested the Mexican tricycle as a cocktail to try, and that ended up being too bitter/smoky for me. Any other recommendations on how to treat mezcal right? Thank you for all that you do. Thank you, Kate. Thank you for your question. Yeah, well, you know, we talked a little bit about the way that mezcal is traditionally made, but I didn't go into the fact that, especially in craft cocktail culture, and specifically in American craft cocktail culture, mezcal is used as an ingredient in cocktails, and it can be done really well. When you're talking about enjoying mezcal in the traditional sense, it is more like, you know, you wouldn't really necessarily make a wine cocktail. It's kind of like that. It's made to appreciate it for what it is. But it's possible to make some really cool cocktails out of it. I've had some nice mezcal cocktails, too.
Well, and I think that's the important note, is that the thing with mass market mezcal is, from its origin, it's a bit more of an artisanal spirit that usually is priced a little higher than what we would like to mix with. You know, your standard mm-hmm. bottle of, like, well-made mezcal is going to run you like 60, 70, 100 bucks. Like, that's standard. So those price points aren't really meant for mixing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like saying mixing with a single malt scotch. Like, you might do it in a little, like you might put a little bit as a topper, you might do a spritz, but like making a full cocktail with like, or like shaking single malt scotch is like something you wouldn't do.
Yeah.
So there, that's some of these more like the artisanal mezcals that are out there, it feels sort of wrong in the history of mezcal to mix them.
Right.
But that being said, there are plenty of mezcals that exist purposely at a price point to be mixed. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about Del Maguey. Del Maguey, just a few years back, started producing Vida Mezcal, which is exactly that. It is their Chuchicapa Mezcal that is proofed down to a slightly lower proof and priced down to a cocktail price. So that profile tends to be like that profile that you find from like mid-range price mezcals, mezcals that you could justifiably mix with, has that smoky quality, and that's just the palette that you're kind of working with.
Right, because it is kind of like we mentioned, it is sort of like the variation between different types of wine. Like, it's possible that you might just not like that particular mezcal, and another mezcal might be more your taste, you know. Or if mezcal just isn't your thing, that's okay too. It's just you know, it's a particular kind of flavor profile, and chances are with all of the mezcals that are out there, there's probably one that you like, but it's probably not going to be one that you would mix with.
Well, exactly. Like, that's, you know, I mean There are mezcals. It's just in the ones we've talked about. Like, Ilegal Mezcal is very, it's a lot softer than the Vida. It's in a similar price range. It's less smoky. You know, when you get into like the different village varietals, there are some that are like insanely fruity and they taste like banana and mango. There are some that are very grassy. There are some that are very stony. There are some that are distinctly smoky. So I do think that if you're interested in mezcal, don't give up on your first bottle. Maybe allow yourself to do some investigation. And when it comes to mixing with mezcal, just like any spirit, mezcal has characteristics that can be highlighted or tamed. So, you know, how do we traditionally mix with mezcal? If you're talking to me, I love that it's smoky.
Well, you like scotch too.
I love scotch. I mean, that's what my favorite drink right now. This is only for if anybody is in literally my immediate vicinity. If you can order from Abe's Pagoda, their to-go cocktail, the Oaxacan Penicillin, which is made with scotch and honey and mezcal.
Ooh.
And lemon. It's so good. But it's like a smoky, like, sweet treat. Mm. I love the smoke of mezcal. I always want to mix with it. But if you don't, like, there are other flavors to be had in mezcal, and sometimes it's about taming one flavor to bring out another. I think one drink that does that really well is the mezcal Negroni, which we're gonna, if you ever had a mezcal Negroni, because of the dominance of Campari in literally anything, it tames a lot of the nose of the smokiness, and that's a big part of tasting is the smell. So you get more of the savory qualities of mezcal, you get a lot more of the earthy qualities, and maybe less of the smoke that you don't like, if that's not a thing you like. So I do think there are ways of mixing mezcal that, you know, it's a kind of a twofold answer. For one, you might want to try other mezcal. One kind of mezcal is like saying, I tried Chardonnay, I don't like white wine. Like, no, there's so much other white wine out there. But the other part is, maybe it's just that the cocktail structure you chose doesn't highlight what you like about it and doesn't downplay what you don't like about it, because that is the true power of mixing cocktails, is you take a spirit, you play up what you like, you downplay what you don't.
Nice. Yeah.
Is that an answer?
Yeah, that's an answer. I think that's a good starting point for an answer, at least, because we're definitely, I mean, for as many times as I just said, traditionally mezcal is drank by itself, we are going to make cocktails out of it, because that's what we do. So this week, this Friday, we're going to, for our virtual happy hour, we will be making some mezcal cocktails. We're actually going to be working with the mezcal that you, Taylor, you mentioned, the Del Maguey Vida, which is, I don't know why I just brought it to the computer to show you. You know what it is.
I know what that is.
So we're going to be working with that spirit because it is that mezcal, because it is made for specifically for making cocktails. So we will continue the answer to this question by showing you some things that you can do. So that's going to be this Friday at 8:30 Eastern Standard Time, because we're in New York. So if you're somewhere else, it might be at a different time. If you're on the West Coast, it's going to be 5:30 and et cetera. There are different time zones. You understand. Wow. Yeah.
They get a real cocktail hour. That's like, I always feel like happy hour at 8:30. Like, oh, 5:30. That's great for you.
Yeah, it's great if you're on the West Coast. It actually is happy hour. I mean, my favorite happy hours are always the ones that go till like 8 or 9. Because I could never, like, when I was working and back when, you know, bars were open, I could never really make it to an actual happy hour, because they're usually in New York, they're usually from like 5 to 7, you know, so I appreciate a longer happy hour. We kind of made a little compromise there, so, you know, but we're going to be doing that. Oh, also, because the day this comes out is Monday, happy May the 4th.
Oh yeah, May the 4th be with you. Hopefully you joined us for our live stream. If not, you can check us out. We made some Star Wars themed cocktails. It's funny, talking the past, talking about the future. This event has definitely happened at this point in time. So if you want some fun content for your May the 4th, check out the video that we have definitely already made. Where we make some Star Wars themed cocktails.
In the future, in the past.
Yes, in the future, in the past. Talk about Star Wars. I am definitely breaking out my Han Solo cosplay. Liz, I don't know what you did. I don't know what you did to meet how good my Han Solo is, but we'll see.
We'll see in the past, in the future. Thank you for everyone who has been tuning in, and thank you for everyone who's been sending us questions while the live stream's happening. Thank you for everybody who's shouting us out on Twitter, and everyone who's joined the Patreon, everyone who's kept their donations or increased their donations. Really, like, we could not make this without you guys. And also thank you to Absurdus for our theme music. And thanks everybody who's supporting us. We love you.
Yes. Yes. Well, all right. I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.
Yeah.